Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, my wonderful listeners, the most advanced thinkers in the field of mental health, maybe even the only advanced thinkers in the field of mental health. I'm just always glad to be here. I have great news. My book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions, which is officially going to be published December 2nd, we have books. So those of you who have taken our special offer up from the website, which is you get the book and a second book, the Antidepressant Fact Book, for buying for buying Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. You get two books, and the Antidepressant Fact Book is actually quite a bonus. It's still regularly on sale at a regular book price. So you'll be getting that for free because we managed to get a very special offer from the publisher on that. So that's available now, and you should be getting the book, should be sent out to you in maybe 2, 3, 4 days. And those of you listening, if you go to the website, you'll see right at the top a green bar with an ad at Bregan.com for the book. And if you sign up now, you'll also get this special pre-publication offer. I don't know how long that will keep the offer going. Certainly, I think through December 2nd, maybe longer. It depends on the response. So the book is out. It's a proud achievement for me. I've been thinking about the issues of guilt, shame, and anxiety for 40 years. I've actually written 3 or 4 manuscripts about it, which I didn't publish because I didn't feel it was right. And then when I began to realize that guilt, shame, and anxiety actually developed during evolution, regular, biological evolutionary process through natural selection, and I realized how little it actually has to do with us as modern human beings, how its function isn't really what it was cracked up to be by natural selection. And all of this is described in the first third of the book. The second third of the book is about the 3 steps to emotional freedom from guilt, shame, and anxiety, primitive emotions built in by evolution and then stimulated by childhood, like all built-in things are. Like instincts, they get elicited and then modified by the environment and also by experience and choice. And then the third part, after the part about the 3 steps to emotional freedom, is about the role of love in our lives. So I move from biological evolution to the role of love as we create it in our lives. And one of the interesting things you'll see in an appendix to the book, one appendix is about my views on drugs, because I can't talk about emotional liberation without warning people about the effects of drugs. But the second one's about Charles Darwin, because Darwin, to my amazement as I studied this more and more, believed that love was the ultimate expression of humanity and required rising above the givens of our social instincts. So it's all, I think, a wonderful book. I haven't actually ever talked about a book, one of my own books, in this way, because I kind of am in love with the book. I love that after 40 years I could put together something meaningful in a new way to take us through our understanding of guilt, shame, and anxiety. It's probably the first unitary concept of guilt, shame, and anxiety, where all three are seen as variations on one another. Anxiety is usually left out of the process. Sometimes shame is, sometimes guilt. But that they all have a certain function, which you will find out about in the book and how to overcome it. So, hey, books are going to go out in the next couple of days, and you'll be getting the book way ahead of pub date. So that's that for now. Now, my guest, Dave, are you there? Dave? Where is my guest? Now, folks, I have to email and ask, well, it's not an email, it's an instant messaging, where is my guest?
Hello there.
Ah, now we're on. Hi,
Peter. Hi, Peter.
You didn't hear me initially, or maybe we weren't.
No,
right.
I'm sorry. The engineer came on to say I was on the wrong line, and I think he's presumably just transferred it. So apologies for that start.
Well, it's not you. I'm sure the engineer apologizes. We have marvelous engineers. It's not easy to run these shows. It's not like there are three guys handling all this. There's one person back there handling the show, the guests.
I'm honored to be asked to be on your show, and I'd endorse a lot of what you just said in the introduction about the primacy of anxiety and guilt, and that, you know, I agree with you completely on that. I think your work, the breadth and depth of your work, has been inspirational to many psychologists around the world.
Oh, that's nice. Usually no one says that until I ask them later in the show, and I stumble and say, you know, I always ask, what role has my work played in your life? Because I do love documenting that. It's been such a shock to me, really genuinely, that the various folks that I have on the show, whom I don't know particularly, I may have heard a little about them, have often been influenced by my work. Folks, we're talking to Dave Traxson, T-R-A-X-S-O-N, Dave Traxson. Dave is an chartered educational psychologist in Great Britain. So once again, I'm trying to keep us in touch with the Brits and what's happening there, at times the Canadians, and once in a while, even further afield. He has been a practitioner for at least 30 years, and he's also been quite involved in reform work. Apparently, increasingly, he's been feeling that the way it's going with children in the Great Britain and the rest of the world and psychiatry is really, really not good. And he's been working on raising issues about psychotropic drugs, and he's really focused on the safeguarding of children, something that I have a lot of feelings about, too. You can find on my website, one of my latest publications is in Children and Society, it's a European journal, and I'm calling in that journal for professionals to start thinking about, you know, how are we going to go about calling for a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children? You know, it just doesn't make any sense at all to treat children with psychoactive substances. So I'm going to give it over to Dave, and would you like to tell folks just a little more about yourself, and then some of the things we'll go talk about, some of these interesting subjects we share in common?
Yeah. I mean, as you say, I've been a practicing educational psychologist for 30-odd years, and during that time, my specialism has always been in behavior. And I personally believe that most children's difficult behaviors are a manifestation of their levels of anxiety and their levels of mental distress, and that that we need to focus on that rather than on punitive measures for dealing with them in class, or even, you know, imprisoning them as young people, which I know is a problem in many countries now. And I think it's been a very, I personally believe that the increased use of psychotropic drugs is actually purely and simply a business plan from the pharmaceutical industry, and which was very consciously worked out about 20 or 30 years ago to systematically market drugs for the child population, which at that time was, was a virgin territory for their for their colonization. And I think it's gone too far. I think, you know, it's gone too far in many countries, but particularly in countries where there's unregulated advertising on television and radio for these kind of drugs, which the main countries, obviously, for that are America and New Zealand.
I'm right on with you. And, folks, it's just not an exaggeration. It's not a conspiracy theory to talk about the business plans of the pharmaceutical industry in cooperation with the, especially the psychiatrists and the pediatricians to get this going. The Pediatric Academy here in the U.S. hand in glove with the drug companies, the psychiatric people hand in glove with the drug companies. And in fact, these business plans are so illegal that they've been paying billions of dollars for them here in the U.S. when they've been sued by the federal government. But it's a drop in the bucket for them. But it is a business plan. There's no question about it. It is not science that has led to the massive drugging of children, nor to the increased drugging of all folks in the Western world and increasingly elsewhere. It's a business plan. I always call it a marketing strategy. I think business plan is even more down earth. I'm really glad to hear you using that language. And then you use, of course, that inflammatory language about colonizing and probably imperialism. Explain what you mean by that.
I write a bit of poetry in that, and I like the juxtaposition of words. And the three words that have really worked for me in summarizing this kind of viewpoint are the three words: psycho-economic imperialism, which I know is very strong, but I think I can justify it, that I think that is the chemical colonization of young developing minds. And let's remember, we're talking about four-year-olds and seven-year-olds being given these toxic substances, so their brains haven't finished growing yet. So it's the chemical colonization of young developing minds for huge commercial profit and also social control. And that definition for me sums up my concern over the last 30 years. And some of those concerns are shared by the professional bodies here in the UK, like the Association of Educational Psychologists, who have been arguing that we should know the effects on the child's brain before we do things that could delay their development with toxicity, you know, because all drugs work because of their toxicity. There isn't a nice bit of a drug that says I'm going to cuddle those little cells over there and help them get better. They might have that long-term effect, but in the short term, they work because of toxicity, because they're either poisoning some cells or poisoning a chemical pathway.
This is absolutely true, folks, and, you know, it's what I initially called the brain-disabling principle of psychiatric treatment. All biopsychiatric interventions, shock, lobotomy, drugs, harm the brain, and their effects are beneficial only to the degree that either the individual or other people prefer the person with a harmed brain. A subdued brain, an artificially euphoric brain, a blunted brain. This is the absolute truth. And, of course, I've been talking about this and documenting it in infinite detail in my books for a long time. The word colonization is so interesting because there's the one concept of colonization which you're probably most thinking about, which is, you know, that one group goes in and takes advantage of another less developed or less powerful group and uses it to its own advantage. There's another medical idea of colonization, you know, where bacteria colonize you. And so yeah. I've got this image I never had before of the of the drug companies going in and colonizing children and then putting these drugs that colonize their brains It's a gruesome image, and we need it. We need gruesome images. And I thank you for them, Dave Traxson. I thank you for these kind of images, because
we just colonizes
have to face how
them,
horrible
like with
it is.
Most colonizing relationships, it develops a dependency relationship where once a person has been colonized or possibly chemically, you know, subjugated to a degree, then the next time in their life they have a difficulty, either emotionally or psychologically, they're going to be drawn to a chemical substance again, whether it's alcohol, prescribed drugs, or any other form of drugs. And we all know now that the most abused drug in America isn't heroin or crack cocaine, but is legally prescribed amphetamines.
Well, amphetamines and benzos, and in fact, it's the whole shebang, because people, all psychiatric drugs make it hard for you to get off them. So we can just throw the whole bunch of drugs into this category of addictive-like drugs, and that even though you may not get pleasure and want to take more and more, you can't get off them. You're dependent on them. Absolutely.
I mean, at the very least, even if it's not as strong as I've just described, it's as you've implied, it's a marketization of normal childhood. It's and that turning things like shyness into psychiatric condition, you know, social affective disorder, and all of these other conditions that have been like pathologized, is about their market value.
Yes, and I would go further, and probably you would too, and say even when a child is really disabled or impaired by emotional issues, which always comes out of abuse, folks. It always comes out of some sort of abuse or neglect, even if it's an unintentional neglect on the part of the parents, that even when a child, you know, is so out of touch that maybe the description fits autism or the description fits psychosis or something, it still doesn't mean that drug companies have any kind of answer at all. In fact, the more injured a child, the more the child needs what ordinary kids need: love, discipline, boundaries, people reaching out. The more the child needs the parents and other adults, and not pills. Pills simply aren't the answer.
And also, Peter, in my view, more naturalistic approaches. Like, I'm really fascinated by the international variation in use of drugs, and I mean, I don't want to give give America unnecessarily a hard time, because I know there are lots of skilled professionals like yourself that are trying to deal with this. But it's quite fascinating that in Europe, in France and Italy, the prescription rate for drugs like Ritalin is 0.15%, 0.15%. In Britain, it's 1.5%. And I think you know what I'm going to say next. In some states in America, like North Carolina, it's 15% just for psychostimulants. Now, that proves in a way that it's not a medical condition, because a medical condition would be more uniform than that. So it's not a naturally occurring epidemic. It's socially constructed. And in France and Italy, the doctors have a special prescription pad, which is a different color, which they pay for the children to join an athletics club or a swimming club or a judo club or a karate club, somewhere where they're going to get a bit of discipline and to be able to channel their feelings and their levels of aggression. And that's the first step that they do. They then use psychological therapies, talking therapies, And that's why they have such a low prescription rate. And that is exactly what our National Institute of Clinical Excellence in Britain recommends, that these other more naturalistic approaches should be used first before we have recourse to chemically drugging our children.
Yes, that's why I'd love to just see professionals decide that it's immoral, illegal, unethical to drug kids at all. And then we would, for those tiny percents that are getting drugged in Britain, there'd be even more alternatives. Certainly it's worse in America. And of course, the figure of 15%, excuse me, that's just as you said, only for the psychostimulants for ADHD. And it represents an average between boys and girls. And for boys, it's 15 or 18. I mean, it's 20% or more. And for girls, it's 10% or less.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, we much easier to find excuses to drug our boys. We've become a nation that hates its boys. And, you know, folks, I love America. I've written a book called Wow, I'm an American. But Dave is absolutely right. We are by far the worst country on the face of the earth when it comes to psychiatric abuse of our children and youth and young adults. We're the worst place to live as a child in terms of being vulnerable to these drugs. And as wonderful as growing up in America is compared to most places in the world, that's a horrendous risk. And a terrible black mark, and something that we as Americans need to just rear up an outrage about. And I hope this show will help inspire that outrage.
Well, I mean, I'm quite a balanced kind of guy, and I don't get shocked by much. But the thing that, and this motivated me to carry on campaigning, really, so that it didn't happen in Britain, was the way that I read reports about what happens to children in state care in America, that where they're given drugs on court orders, and if the parents think that are worried about the effect of the court order, the effect of the drug, the parents can actually be prosecuted if they decide not to give their foster child a drug. And then if the child refuses, the parents want the child to take it, but the child refuses, then they can have like peripatetic squads of medics coming to give them the drug intravenously or whatever. And I read that was quite common practice, which, you know, is very concerning. And certainly, you know, we need to stop that that practice spreading.
It's not Dave, and again, we're talking to Dave Traxson, Traxson, from the United Kingdom, a chartered educational psychologist and a really intelligent and active reformer on behalf of children. I don't think that practice is common in the U.S. with children, but it happens, and it's then a threat that spreads far beyond the practice. You know, once you have the threat in place, you only have to behead a couple of kids, you know, or parents. Once you have the practice, and folks, I don't think that's a horrible exaggeration. When we start giving kids these drugs, we're taking their heads away.
Yes,
I just, you're inspiring
absolutely.
Me, Dave, to just be more graphic than usual. But it isn't a common practice in the U.S., but it's a threatening practice.
I think the common practice is to give them drugs, as I've read it, if I've interpreted it right, which I think I have, is that drugs are commonly given to children in the care system under a court order, and that changes the dynamics of how the foster parents and the child can respond.
Oh, that is for sure. Yes. I didn't know you were talking about the foster care system. I thought you meant in general. Yes, foster care.
The example I was giving was purely in the children in state care.
That's absolutely true. Now, I've actually intervened in some of the non-foster care cases and had judges come to agree with me, and I've helped get parents their kids back. The foster care system would be even harder to intervene in because it is all wrapped up with involuntary treatment and court orders, and the parents are at a distance, and the guardians, they rubber stamp the druggers. It's a terrible, terrible circumstance. It's a disaster, folks, what happens to our children in this country and parents in regard to drugs. It's really time to view this as a widespread expression of child abuse. And I don't see the parents as mostly responsible for the abuse. They are misled, pushed, told their kids are biochemical imbalances. And in some cases, among the poorer segments of our society, and maybe amongst some of the better off too, this is a way that parents keep their heads afloat financially, as they have their kids on disability for psychiatric purposes, in return for which they hand their kids over weekly or monthly for their drugs, and they can have two or three children or more on disability and get that income.
Well, that is absolutely the same in Britain, Peter. It's called disability living allowance, and for a child that is claimed to have quite severe behaviours, that is £600, about $900 a month. And obviously, if they've got more than one child, that becomes like equivalent of a salary, you know.
I think that's even more than our families get here.
That's the higher level. There's two levels. There's £300 a month and £600 a month. But often, if there's evidence that the children have got behavioural problems at night, which might or might not be the case, you know, depending on where the evidence has come from, they can get the higher level of £600 a month.
This is so important. So important. And you can be sure without folks like you fighting against it, Dave, it's just going to get worse and worse because it's driven by the profit motive. And folks, you know, who listen to this show, you know that I think that it's not that the free market system is great. It's just generally better than the other alternatives. But the free market system only works if you really push on ethics and you hold companies accountable. And that's one reason why I participate in lawsuits against corporations, because corporations tend to be very heartless, more heartless even than the prescribers themselves, who can be very heartless because they don't see themselves as one individual with a responsibility. And we just need all kinds of methods for letting the corporations know they can't do this to children. Back off from our kids' corporations. Absolutely.
And I think after the break, Peter, if we perhaps talk about some, that's kind of set the context, but if we can talk about some common sense, some practical ways of parents and professionals, you know, challenging that dubious practice.
Yes, I think that'll be a very, very good thing to continue with. Folks, I hope that you're finding this show enlightening. If you've been following me for a couple of years on the show, you know I'm just getting increasingly outraged. You know, when I wrote Toxic Psychiatry in 1991, I had a couple of chapters, one on about children, one on the drugs, one on the myth of ADHD. And this is actually worse than I anticipated when I wrote Toxic Psychiatry. You know, I didn't see it getting this bad, where you'd have 20% of high school age boys just on these drugs. We don't even know the percentage on all the drugs. It may be 35. It may be that half our children, before they're done, are going to be diagnosed and drugged for some part of their life. Nobody's looking at the whole conglomeration of awful drugs and diagnoses we give our children, and looking at what's the exposure in a lifetime, what's that percentage. Well, we're going to be going to break. My guest is Dave Traxson, T-R-A-X-S-O-N, educational psychologist from Great Britain. Thanks for listening. We will be back in a minute or two or three. That's my music, folks. It's the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on this marvelous station. Don't forget brn.fm. Keep it in your heart. If you want, make a contribution. There's hardly anywhere else that this radio show could exist. And I'm just grateful for that. I always want to express my gratitude for that. My guest, Dave Traxson, T-R-A-X-S-O-N, he has a blog that's on COPE-YP. That's COPE-YP at blogspot.com. Let me just be a little self-centered for a minute and remind you that, to our surprise, my new book is in the house here a couple of weeks ahead of official publication time. So those of you who have gone on the website, breggin.com, and ordered the book, you're going to be getting two books sent out to you in the next few days, because you're going to get free my antidepressant fact book. It's a fabulous companion piece to Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which is a book about identifying and overcoming your negative legacy emotions, the stuff given to us by evolution and childhood. I love this book. I'm really hoping it will help liberate innumerable people. And you can still go on the website and still get it for a while. I don't know how long. Still get it at the price for the book plus a second book, which is almost as expensive if you buy it anywhere. So, Dave.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the plug for the blog. Shall I just explain what the acronym stands for, so that the COPE is... Sorry?
Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The COPE stands for Challenging Overprescription by Professionals in Education. And then the YP stands for young people, so it's like for young people, and it's at blogspot.com. And I think those that notion of challenging, because what I'd like to move on to in this next half is that I'm not suggesting to anybody that they should, be rude to doctors or be threatening to doctors, but there's always a healthy notion of intellectual challenge. That when you make an assertive challenge of another professional, often the other professional will listen and respond positively. And that's exactly what we are achieving with a thing that's on the blog called the Practical Protocol, which is the top item on my blog. And this is based on what you were talking about, Peter, just before the break, about using ethics to actually challenge psychiatrists or pediatricians when a child mental health worker has a genuine concern. And it might be worth just, it's only short, but just reading from our code of conduct, which is simply that you must not do anything or allow someone else to do anything that you have good reason to believe will put the health and safety of a service user in danger. This includes your own actions and those of other professionals. You should take appropriate action to protect the rights of children and vulnerable groups if you believe they are at risk. And that comes from what's called our Healthcare Professionals Council. And I think that gives people in the mental health field what I call the ethical legitimacy to make a phone call or to write a letter to a psychiatrist or to a pediatrician to say you have a professional concern about either the side effects of the drug that the child is on or why the child was put on the drug in the first place, because that behavioral pattern wasn't happening, say, for example, at school. And we did a survey in the area of the Britain where I live, and we found that in 47% of cases, the prescribing doctor hadn't rung the school to see if that behaviour existed at school. And I think that's scandalous. You know, at the very least, medics that prescribe these drugs should triangulate their data. They should see that that behaviour exists at school, it exists at home, or it exists in other situations. And that's the minimum requirement for even considering the use of a psychotropic drug. And the I think the Royal College of Psychiatry in Britain would agree with that.
Well, there's a lot to comment on there and to discuss. It's another example of how much more advanced the psychiatry, or the psychiatric viewpoint of children is in Great Britain than in the United States. Because if in this country, first of all, if you did a survey of how many prescribers contacted the school, I think you would find it wasn't like, you said 47% didn't.
47%, yeah.
All right, here it would be 100% didn't. It would be
right.
Almost unheard of for a practitioner here to get in touch with the school. I do. Schools are shocked when I do. I've actually gone and sat in classrooms. Schools can't believe it. I've gone to some planning committees, not very often. I mean, it's a very time-consuming and largely unpaid thing to do, but I do it when necessary. The other thing is that if in this country a psychologist, social worker, or counselor wrote a note to the local psychiatrist saying anything remotely critical of psych drugs, they might find the psychiatrist writing a letter, not back to them, but to their disciplinary committee in the U.S.
Right.
You would not get a warm welcome. What I advise people to do in the U.S. is to follow the code. I think the code is marvelous. And to feel free to educate and to feel it's your ethical duty to educate parents and older kids about the drugs and then let them make up their mind what to do. And if there's some possibility of talking to the prescriber without then having to get a lawyer to defend yourself. And by the way, I have a blanket offer, which is if people get in trouble, if psychologists get in trouble for standing up on prescription issues and they can't afford my fees, I'll testify on their behalf for free.
Yeah, so, well, that's a fantastic offer, Peter.
You know, so folks, you know, keep that in mind. But the truth is, if a psychologist, if a therapist in this country talks to the family honestly, there's very little risk of recrimination. There's some, but there's a tiny, tiny risk of recrimination. You have the ethical duty. And if the doctor complains and says you're not a doctor, you say, no, you're not a prescriber, but you are trained about drugs, you've read about drugs, and you feel it's your ethical duty to discuss drugs with your clients, and it's their choice.
It is
your ethical duty. You can
quickly
know more than the psychiatrist about the drugs. So, but it's a dicier situation and a less safe situation than here in the country, in our country. But absolutely follow that code, folks.
Yeah. I mean, the one area where we're having a lot of success in Britain is when children are on more than one psychoactive drug, you know, what we call a drug cocktail. And we're finding that when psychologists ring up the psychiatrist or pediatrician and share a concern about that as to how those drugs are interacting, that I would say it's as high as 8 times out of 10 the prescribing doctor actually amends the prescription. And our pharmacists are also challenging it more and more. I had a case where the pharmacist for one of the families I was involved with, when the parent took in this prescription, which was a maximum dose of a psychostimulant, maximum dose of an antipsychotic drug, and then the mother had asked for the child to be put on an antidepressant because he was getting depressed on the other two drugs. The pharmacist rang up his professional association before he responded. And when the mother came back to pick up the prescription, he said, I cannot issue this prescription because it is life-threatening. I've been advised that it's a life-threatening combination. And you will have to go back to the psychiatrist involved and say that it was life-threatening. And I refused to issue it. So pharmacists are also quite commonly now refusing to issue prescriptions for these psychoactive drug combinations. Would that happen in America?
Well, it is a pharmacist's duty, I believe, under their own ethics to do that. It rarely happens in the U.S. in my experience. I've been in a number of legal cases, however, where pharmacists have warned in writing doctors, but they haven't refused to prescribe. They've said, we won't prescribe until we hear back from you. And in the two or three cases fresh in my mind, the doctors just said, no, fill the prescription. I mean, I think it's different here in the U.S. I think it is much worse here, in particular in regard to children. The stranglehold of the pharmaceutical industry on the medical profession and their mutual stranglehold on children is an abomination in this country, and it's much worse than in Great Britain.
Europe as a whole, really. I mean,
Europe as a whole.
I mean, I've mentioned Italy and France, but some of the Scandinavian countries are incredibly progressive with some of the psychological approaches that they use. There's one approach in Denmark where they have the reportedly the best mental health in the world, you know, from World Health Organization studies. And they've developed an approach called social pedagogy, which is a 5-year training course. And a social pedagogue only has 5 active cases. And if necessary, they will see those 5 active cases every single day in order to work through difficulties or to counsel and to mentor and to support young people with difficult decisions in their life and to reduce their levels of distress. And one of the startling statistics about that is that in Denmark, they get 6 out of 10 children in the looked-after sector. Or state, you know, that'd be state care with you. 6 out of 10 in Denmark that looked after children in state care go to either university, college, or a high-level apprenticeship. In Britain, the figure is 6 out of 1,000. So these psychologically based approaches are incredibly successful at transforming young people's lives.
Dave, thanks for this incredible information. I've asked Dave to do an essay for our free newsletter, folks. Remember, we have a free newsletter. You just go on to Bregan.com or go on to empathictherapy.org, free newsletter. We have over 5,000 subscribers, and it's an e-newsletter. And I want you to talk about that. That new intervention, professional intervention. I'm not surprised at all. You know, you give proper psychosocial attention to children, work with their families, get resources around them, don't blame the child, instead examine the stresses in the child's life, and kids get better.
Absolutely. Because I know we wanted to talk a little bit about psychological formulation, which is a growing field in Europe and in America.
I'm not sure how much it's growing in America, but maybe you could tell me about that. I don't think it's growing very rapidly here,
right?
But it's a good thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it covers this this whole area really, and social pedagogy is a very good example of that, because the majority of the training in the 5-year course is on the attachment theory and psychological theories and a wide range of strategies to deal with young people's distress. Because like so many people, I know you've had Lucy Johnson on your show before, who's developed the British Psychological Society guidelines on psychological formulation. And she believes that a lot of mental distress in young people, and I know you alluded to this earlier, is the result of early traumatic experiences. And the most common traumatic experience that she highlights is domestic violence. And that the traumatizing effect that domestic violence has on a child in terms of raising their levels of anxiety and distress.
I mean, that's an interesting thing for Lucy to conclude. In the U.S., in terms of reporting, by far and away, the most common trauma for children is neglect in infancy.
Yeah.
Neglect in infancy. And that's hard to show up later on if it isn't caught. And, you know, and if the government doesn't intervene, you know, who even learns that a child's been left alone to cry for 10 hours, you know, in an abandoned apartment while the parents are out doing drugs, you know, unless the neighbors report the crying. And but it's child neglect. Abuse is the most obvious, I think, and the most the one you can actually go back and say, well, look at the trauma. But I think it's neglect. It's a medical neglect, love neglect, attention neglect, food neglect, clothing neglect. And that is, there's a lot of that in the U.S. and I'm sure throughout the world.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure in Great Britain. I'm sure it's more common in Great Britain than child abuse. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and I think you're right, and that more and more professionals are considering the importance of issues like domestic violence, and not just physical violence, but incessant like verbal violence, and certainly some of the situations that I visit. You know, the volume and the level of people's verbal aggression to each other is absolutely exhausting. I mean, I get exhausted as a visitor, let alone as a person that's permanently experiencing it. And I think that's common the world over, really. The insulting and swearing and demeaning language that is often used about children in particular.
Absolutely, and it's not just confined to the poor or lower economic
classes. Oh, no.
It's worse there, but it's sure not confined to it.
No. I mean, one of the things that your listeners might be interested in on my blog is the Cope YP is a model that I've developed for looking at this psychological formulation, and I'll try and explain it in a couple of sentences, really. But I'm quite excited by it. It's like a little mathematical formula, really, and I'll just explain it quickly. And it believes that a human being's optimal performance is affected by a whole range of conditions and situations. And that optimal performance is the total of people's potentials, their human potentials, like their creativity potential or their work-related potential or their emotional intelligence, and their personality factors. And those are added together, their potential factors and their personality factors. You then take off interference, which is all the things that we've been talking about in the last 5 minutes, you know, those very distressing and emotionally strong factors that we've been talking about, like neglect and abuse. And then the magic thing which comes on at the end to counteract those or to build on those is the support that we put in place, the loving support that professionals and families put in place, whether it's the school, the psychologist, or the family. And that can include, you know, all the therapies, all the art therapies, the music therapies, the expressive therapies, and all the sports and social pedagogy and all those things that we've been referring to in this program. So you, in order to optimize a human being's performance, you've got to build up their personality factors and their potentials, recognize those and celebrate those, and reduce the levels of interference, the negative interference in their life, so that with support, they can thrive as human beings.
You know, so much with you on this. One of the things that are in my practice I see all the time is that family, mom and dad will come in, and maybe the designated patient, the child, and this kid will be bright and have a wonderful smile if they haven't been drunk too much and so on. And then I read the report the parents bring with me, and it's all about what's the matter with this child, hardly anything about what's good about the child.
No.
We really need to get away from psych testing that finds out your executive function isn't working, or you've got the learning disabilities and all this
nonsense.
Or working
memory problems. I've had about 20 people explain to me what working memory is, and I still don't understand it. You know, and certainly wouldn't want to categorize anybody as having a bad one, you know, on the basis of some of the tests that are used for it, you know.
Yeah,
and,
it's an industry.
It's a marketization. It's a marketization of assessment.
Yep, exactly. Stay away from all of that stuff, folks. You know, if you meet with a family, you're going to see within 10 minutes, in the home in 10 seconds, you may see just what the child's trying to cope with. And kids need love. They need discipline. They need boundary setting. And the more disturbed the child, the more they just need what every other kid needs. It's not very complicated. And in the case of abuse and neglect, of course, we have to do everything in our power to prevent it. And the fact that it's difficult, takes resources, is simply a fact of life and shouldn't be used as an excuse for drugging the victim further. Every time we give a psychoactive drug to a child, we are re-victimizing the victim.
Yeah. And a phrase that Lucy uses, which I love, is we are re-traumatizing the child, you know, which it might not be people's intention, but that's the way it could be interpreted if you're looking at things holistically, you know.
Absolutely. By the way, I just Googled COPE YP, and it's very easy to get to my guest, Dave Traxson, by Googling COPE, COPE-YP, and right at the top comes up. Or if you want to get more complicated, COPE-YP@blogspot.com.
And there's a lovely Nelson Mandela quote on the heading there, which I'd just like to repeat, which is that there is no better way of assessing the quality of a society than the way it chooses to treat its children.
No doubt. No doubt at all. Dave, in your biography, I don't see the letters that usually come after a name. What do I put there when I put my little summary up for this show?
In terms of, I've got a master's degree in child psychology.
And, but like, what is it, like MA or PhD?
MA. And now psychologists have to have a PhD, but when I trained, it wasn't that case. So I've got a master's, which is a recognized qualification. And I'm also chartered by the British Psychological Society.
Good. So you're a chartered psychologist.
Yeah, chartered psychologist, yeah.
Chartered psychologist, Dave Traxson. That's who we're talking to, folks. I love this man. I've never talked to him before we got on the phone.
Likewise. The feeling's mutual, Peter.
Yeah, yeah. This is such an important show we're having, folks. listen, you want to save adults, save the children. It all begins there. we're more and more seeing these horrendous chronologies of children put on drugs, becoming career mental patients, ending up on multiple drugs. The poor child starts out with a mild jumpiness and that the teacher doesn't know how to calm down or doesn't want to pay attention to. And the kid's put on Ritalin when he's 40 years old because of the drugs added to the drugs added to the drugs and the diagnosis added to the diagnosis. A lot of these people are becoming disabled 40-year-olds and even disabled children. And it's a part of this colonizing of what Dave Traxson calls the psycho-economic colonizing or imperialism in regard to children. It's real, and it's there because of the collaboration between the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry, and particularly in our country, we're looking at psychiatry and pediatrics. Dave, I want to stay in touch with you, and I'll be emailing you about some things we can do together.
Likewise.
We'll have you on again.
And good luck with your latest book. It sounds wonderful. I'll order a copy.
Thank you. If you order it from the website, you get the antidepressant fact book.
Yes, I will.
With it. Thanks, folks. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this show as much as I did.